We are continuing this series tonight on this conversation about who is Jesus. Because in Chi Alpha, what are we? We're Jesus followers. We're a community of people that are on CSU's campus that are passionate about this rabbi from 2,000 years ago. And what does that mean? And why are we passionate about Jesus? And so tonight we're continuing this series looking at these times where if you're going to get to know somebody, because it's like, what does it mean to follow somebody? But if you're going to get to know somebody, if you're even going to follow somebody, it's important to let them explain who they are. And you know, there's a lot of concepts of Jesus, and there's kind of the Jesus, you know, of the politician, and there's the Jesus of the, you know, street preacher over on the plaza, and some of them might be good, some of them maybe not, some of them true, maybe not. But what does Jesus say about who Jesus is? How does he define himself? And so we're looking at these accounts where Jesus says, I am, in the gospel. But more than just that, we want to ask this question throughout the semester and throughout our lives, what does this matter? What does this mean to me? And if Jesus is who he claims to be and what he claims is true about who he is, then what does that mean for me as a college student at CSU, as someone working and having, you know, got a boyfriend, got a girlfriend, got, you know, school and work and balance of life and trying to figure out who I am and what I'm about? What does Jesus have to do with answering that question and those questions? And so tonight we are continuing in John, but we're going into chapter 8. And in verse 12 it says, when Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. The Pharisees charged him, here you are appearing as your own witness. Your testimony is not valid. And Jesus answered, even if I testify on my own behalf, my testimony is valid. For I know where I come from and where I am going. But you have no idea where I come from or where I am going. You judge by human standards. I pass judgment on no one, but if I do judge, my decisions are true because I am not alone. I stand with the Father who sent me. In your own law, it is written that the testimony of two witnesses is true. I am one who testifies for myself. My other witness is the Father who sent me. Then they asked him, where is your Father? You do not know me or my Father, Jesus replied. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. He spoke these words while teaching in the temple courts near the place where the offerings were put. Yet no one seized him because his hour had not yet come. I am not a physicist, but I do love physics. And I was reading this book by Sean Carroll this summer called Deeply Hidden Things. And it's kind of this look at his theory on quantum mechanics and how it works. And if you don't know who Sean Carroll is, he's a pretty famous physicist. He's kind of a renowned atheist in our world. But he, when you come to this conversation about, like, what do you do with reality? Why does reality work the way it does? It's really hard to really come up with a good answer. And so you get into like the quantum world and it gets really weird and funny. But why does the world work this way and not that way? Because if you actually look at the smallest elements in the world, it's equally possible that it could be like this or could be like that. So why is it the way that it is? And Sean's argument was actually that in every microsecond, the universe is exploding or replicating, copying itself in almost an infinite number of copies in every moment. It's called the mini universe theory, not to be mistaken as the multiverse, but mini worlds theory. That's basically like in every second, there's a quadrillion of you being replicated, and one of you is doing what's right, and one of you is doing what's wrong, and one of you is being loving, and one of you is acting hateful towards that relationship, and one of you is like every potential is being realized. Because without God, it gets really complicated to try to figure out like why things actually work the way they do. But I think even after reading his book, I thought, you know, I think he's not actually that far off in a lot of things. Because there are so many potentials that are being realized without God's observation, that if even physicists are kind of like, if God is observing things, this is like changes the way that quantum would work. But with God in the mix, There is a difference between the worlds with God in it and without God in it. Potentials, all kinds of potentials, are being realized in the world without God. And so here is Jesus, and he's contrasting God, not God, light, dark. And he's saying, I am the light. But whenever we look at Scripture, we have to understand this idea that, like, hey, yeah, the world is screwed up, and God has a hope, and there's a lot of things, a lot of suffering, a lot of hurt, a lot of pain, a lot of things that you've gone through, a lot of things that our world has gone through, a lot of things happening in our own hearts, the things that we have done as a result that are not God's will. But as Jesus comes in, he says, I'm the light, and things are transformed through me. There's things that change through me. But when we look at Scripture, we have to ask the question, what did this mean to the original hearers? It's not enough to be like, hey, you know, this modern, you know, Western American perspective of like, yeah, light, it's cool. Like we, you know, what did the original hearers of Jesus understand when he said, I am the light? And so to do that, we're going to do a quick journey. So buckle up, Dorothy. We're going to ride through this. You can take notes. If you want to follow along, that's awesome. If you get lost, it's okay. It's up on the screen as well. But Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning. We're going to start. In the beginning, God created. God created. He's a creator God. He's an innovator. He's artistic, and he loves to create. But he created the heavens and the earth. Now, we can talk about, you know, was it, you know, 5 billion, 7 billion, you know, 6 days, you know, 7,000 years ago. We talk about all that, but he created. Now, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. God saw that light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. So from the very beginning, the Jewish understanding, this ancient Jewish poem of creation and of design and of intent by their creator that they're following, is a story of God is light, and out of that light, he is creating light, that he is separating this light. He's making the world in a way that is good and is beautiful and is made to sustain life and be able to create life. And there's all kinds of goodness that we see before Adam and Eve make some bad dietary choices, and things get a little rough. But we keep moving. In Exodus, the story continues, and God continues to try to bring humanity back to the garden, metaphorically. He keeps trying to bring them back to that place where his goodness is felt and experienced in the world. And so in Exodus, we see God is reaching out to this one people group called the Israelites, and they are in bondage in Egypt, and so he's freeing them. They're looking, they're searching out who he is and looking for him, and they're crying out to him saying, God, where are you? And he says, I'm here. And he sends this guy Moses to help and delivers Israel from the slavery and the persecution and the suffering that they were in there, and brings them through the desert. And through the desert they go, and God is leading them because they don't really know where they're supposed to go and what they're supposed to do. So in Exodus chapter 13, it says, by day, Israel is in the desert, and by day the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so that they could travel by day or night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. And so Israel's understanding of God is this God who is leading them, is guiding them towards their future and their hope and their purpose, their joy, that God is directing them, and he is a God of light, and that he is the light in their world, guiding them through the darkness. Now we keep going a little further over, and there's a lot of things that happen, but we get to this point where Israel is now in the promised land, and they're living there, and they're having a good time of it. And they decide they want to have some kings. They want to have a king in their life. And so this king, first they have one guy. He doesn't work out so good. So they get another guy. They fire him, get another guy. And this guy, David, he's a guy that loves God. And basically through this experience, God's like, hey, I'm going to lead your descendants to become the kings of Israel. And so Israel's like, hey, we've had God in this kind of this tent throughout the desert, but now we want somewhere more stable, more consistent for him to stay. And so they're like, we want to build a temple, but God tells David, no, it's not for you to do that. And so his son Solomon builds a temple. And in 1 Kings, I'm just trying to look at my notes here, but 1 Kings, 8:10. So 1 Kings 8:10. It's on page 325 on my Bible, but I don't know what it's on yours. And in chapter 8, Solomon has built this incredible temple, and it's one of the great wonders of the ancient world, and he's dedicating it to his God. And interestingly, it happens during the Feast of Tabernacles, which we're going to get back to, but this is the same feast that Jesus is talking during in the first passage that we read. So this is at the same time. But Solomon's dedicating the temple, and he says in verse 10, when the priests withdrew from the holy place, the cloud, remember the cloud by day, the fire by night, that same presence, that same cloud filled the temple of the Lord. And the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled his temple. And so this idea of the glory of God, the Shekinah of God, this presence of God, that to Israel it was so tangible. You know, Moses at one time says, hey, I want to see your face. And God's like, no, it's too much. It would just blow your circuits. But that presence, it would appear shrouded, kind of covered, so that they would see sort of the representation of God as light and in this cloud. And he came and he dwelled among the people of God. All right, so not only, though, was God this God of their story, of their history, of the narrative of Israel throughout time, but it was also this picture of light was a picture of who God was in his character, in his nature. So Psalm 27, if we keep just moving over to the right in our Bibles, if you get to the Psalms, and Psalms 27 says in verse 1, it says, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? And so the Lord is the light of my salvation. Who shall I fear? In my anxiety, in the things that come against me, in the situations of my life that I find myself in, he is the light. He is my hope. He is my peace. He is that place of comfort and joy, despite the external world. The world around you, the world right now says, basically, we need the world around us to comfort us. So anything that we don't enjoy, makes us feel uncomfortable, we don't agree with, is offensive to us because we need peace. And the only way we get peace is by making the external world peaceful to our perspective. But how do we do that when we have all kinds of different perspectives and worldviews and ideas and beliefs? And yet, to God, he's like, no, I am your peace. That place, despite the external world, despite the troubles and traumas and struggles that you go through, I'm there. I'm with you. I'm hope. I am light. Isaiah 9, we're going to keep going. We're getting back to John here. We're moving over. Page 646, right? No. Okay. So, not on my app. It doesn't have pages. Okay. Isaiah 9, verse 2 says, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. And if you keep moving down just a little bit, but in picking up back in verse 6, it says, for to us a child is born, for us a child is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne. Remember that king that Solomon was the son of. And over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever, the zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish it. Right? And so God is a God not just of redeeming our past, not just giving us peace in the present, but he's a God of our hope for our future. He's a God that has a plan. And there's this hope for this child. And interestingly, we'll get more into this next week, but that child is called a lot of things. a lot of pretty divine things in Isaiah, but this is the hope for Israel. All right, one more, we'll keep moving, and we'll move on. But Micah 7:8. How many of you guys have ever read Micah? Anybody? Yeah, hey, come on, Joel. Yeah, right, intern. Read it through his reading plan. All right, Micah 7:8. Do not gloat over me, my enemy. Though I have fallen, I will rise. Though I sit in darkness, the Lord will be my light. Even when we fall short, even when we fall short of God, even when we fall short of our own standards, even when we fall short and others use it as an excuse to gloat and to justify, I have peace, I have hope, because I have the light of God with me, and I will get back up, because he is my judge and he is my hope. So this is the idea to Israel. When he says, when Jesus says, I am the light of the world, he is talking to a bunch of Jews who understand light in a very symbolic and literal way, in a very tangible, like he is the guy who led us through the desert, and he is the God that has given me hope and peace in my now and in my situation. That the idea of light is a deeply meaningful and profound idea. Deeply profound. In fact, we're going to see here in a second that they wanted to even kill him for it. But we have to understand, not only was this light a meaningful concept, but the context of this story, so profound. I don't know. This is just incredible. It's like food to my soul, like understanding just how profound Jesus is when he's saying some of these things. But he's talking during not Feast of Tabernacles, although they had a feast, but the celebration. It was one of the four holidays that Israel would celebrate every year. And it was a celebration for two things. One, it was a celebration that was saying, hey, the harvest has come in. And it's at the end of the harvest, and we have enough food to get through winter. We have enough food to sustain us. And it was also a celebration because it was a celebration that God had led them to the promised land that was providing for them. That yes, they had to labor and work and strive and toil to get that food into the storehouses, but now they could celebrate, because the only reason why they had that ability and had the resources and had the means to do that was because God had walked them through the desert. And so it was also a remembrance of how they walked through the desert to get to this place of fulfillment. You know, a lot of times students are like, you know, that whole thing, God didn't help me, I helped me. And I'm like, yeah, but maybe you worked hard. I hope you did. God's not going to, you know, ace your test for you tomorrow if you didn't study. But with what brain are you using? And with what means are you resourcing? And with what experience and family dynamic and heritage and dynamics of culture and resources and opportunities that have nothing to do with you? What opportunities has God given you that have led you to that ability to then bring in the harvest in your own life? See, so they recognize, they're remembering, okay, God, you were ultimately in control. You were ultimately leading me to this place. And so there is this symbolism of the desert, of going through the desert. And John, in chapters 6, 7, and 8, we went through these three. In 6, last week with bread, he's referencing the manna. And then in chapter 7, he's referencing the water, that he's like the spring of water, where Israel was thirsty, you're going to die from thirst, and Moses strikes the rock and water pours out and saves Israel. That God is the water that sustains us. And now in chapter 8, he is the light which was leading them in the desert. And so John is trying to draw out through what he was highlighting, there's this connection that Jesus is constantly connecting in 6, 7, and 8, this idea that he is these things. That actually, he doesn't just say, hey, I'm like that light. Hey, this is like a good metaphor to me. He's actually saying, I am that light. That I am that bread. That I am that place of comfort and redemption. That actually those things are like me. That those experiences you had are like me, not me like them. And so he's saying, I'm the truer reality in your life. So not only is there just that idea, but Jesus is also talking, and this is the last one, and we'll kind of get into some maybe more application things. But he is also talking here, not just during this celebration, during this holiday of tabernacles. And Israel would literally, still to this day, rabbinic Jews will live in tents, essentially, kind of built tents for this holiday, remembering walking through the desert. But at that time, Jesus, it says, if we read chapter 7 and 8, we see it's also in a part of the temple. He is at the part of the temple where every night they would have this big, for lack of a better term, bonfire. Every night they would have this big celebration, and there's kind of this idea, the Shekinah came to the temple, and we're celebrating by lighting this bonfire, remembering when this God led us through the desert with his light. And so at night he would be light, and they're celebrating the light of God in the temple, and they would light it for night after night after night, and they would have these big dance parties. I mean, you thought, you know, you had fun, you know, last Friday, I'm glad, you know, with our little dance party here, but this is like all of Israel having this giant dance party, and they're celebrating God as light in the temple. And yet, on the last night, they didn't do the bonfire. The last night they didn't, and it may be just because logistically they were just kind of like wrapping things up, or maybe it had to do with certain other aspects. One thing is clear, that if you actually read the story of Ezekiel, that there is this declaration that Ezekiel makes. He basically declares Ichabod. Everybody say Ichabod. Ichabod, right? It's kind of a fun word to say. It's a real serious word, though. It basically meant the glory is gone and we're grieving it. And so Ezekiel says he sees the presence of God. That cloud that came down on the temple, it left. It's gone. The light is gone. The presence of God is gone. And that temple was destroyed, and Israel built another temple, which is where we see the story of Jesus. But there was this feeling that something is missing. The light never returned. They built the building, but there's something missing in the Holy of Holies. There's something absent there. And so it is at the last night, Jesus standing where they would have been lighting the bonfire, representing the light, walking them through the desert. And it's in the symbolism of this space and in this moment that all of Israel is like remembering the light and grieving that the light isn't here, that Jesus stands up and he says, I am the light. And not just for Israel, I am the light of the whole world. So that declaration would go against a lot of what we in our world often think, believe, a lot of what students at CSU feel about who God is and what it means for us. And so I want to just kind of talk about two things here for the rest of our time here tonight. But the main points, I thought it'd be interesting to kind of talk about them through the two main objections to Jesus here being the light. And one is this, although students wouldn't say it this way, this is where oftentimes what many of your friends would probably have, you've talked about, if you are a follower of Jesus, or if you aren't, maybe you are in this place. But oftentimes people say, aren't we all in dark when it comes to knowing God? We often think we only see, you know, it's arrogant, it's prideful to think that you understand, that you see God, that he has revealed himself to you. How arrogant that must be. Oftentimes, there's kind of this reference to like a popular metaphor of a bunch of people that are blindfolded, and so they're in the dark, and they're touching an elephant, and one guy says, I feel the trunk, and so it feels like a rope, and another one's touching the leg, so they think it's a tree, and the other one is touching the ear, so they think it's like a fan, and they say, like, how arrogant it is to think that you have light, that you can see something so big, so vast, the divine. And yet, it's actually arrogant to argue that only you're the one that actually can see that everyone else is blind, that you're the only one that actually sees how everyone else in the world only sees part of God and you see the whole picture. I think of Timothy Keller, in his book, The Reason for God, it's a great just look at the arguments for God. But He says this, it's a little bit longer quote, but if you bear with me, he said, Buddhism doesn't believe in a personal God at all. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all believe in a God who holds people accountable for their beliefs and practices and whose attributes could not be all reduced to love. Right? Because when it says love, love what? What are you loving? And the beliefs are different. They're intrinsically deviant in how they deviate from one to another. Ironically, the insistence that doctrines do not matter is really a doctrine itself. It holds a specific view of God, which is touted as superior and more enlightened than that which is touted as than beliefs of most major religions. So the proponents of this view do the very thing they forbid in others. And a little bit later, he says, how could you possibly know that no religion can see the whole truth unless you yourself have the superior comprehensive knowledge of spiritual reality you just claimed that none of the religions have? So if you're like, hey, all of them are equally valid, because we kind of live in a world where we want everybody to be right because we find value in the sameness. And so when we talk about God, it's like, well, we all have to be right or else you're saying you're superior, which is not actually what Jesus says, because at the cross, our sin makes us all equal in our failing, in our shortcoming. But that aside, what Keller is getting at is that, like, hey, it's actually arrogant to argue that you see better, that the secularist today is doing the very thing that they're arguing you're doing, and yet they're pretending like they're not. That everyone is wrestling with truth. That you know, in science that we live in today, and I know that our world is wrestling with the scientific and the spiritual and how they work together, but in science, it's easy to realize that there are ideas that are true and ideas that are not. Ideas that are, we say, enlightened, and ideas that are not. And yet, it does not make one of us better or worse for how we think or believe, but it does mean one can be true or more true, and one maybe less so. But here in our world, we often say, no, we're all in the dark. Other people, though, would say, well, we're all equal in that nobody is right. Nobody knows the truth, because there is no God. There is no reality outside of the physical. And so we're all equally doomed in this world. William Lane Craig, I made reference to this a little bit last week, but go a little further. William Lane Craig is one of the leading philosophers of our day. He's a Christian theologian as well, and he makes this reference in his book, what's it called, On Guard. And he says, if you don't believe in God, then you come to this idea that there is no purpose, meaning, or value. That your life has no value. It's a cold, indifferent world that accidentally popped out of the vacuum, and it will die a cold, indifferent death, and your life has no value to it. And it has no meaning, because no value, there's no significance to it. And so what's the purpose? Well, there is no purpose. And so the world then says, you know, it's funny right now, because the world is in a funny tension. On one side, it's saying, hey, we believe that there is a real morality. And honestly, I think your guys' generation, more than my generation when I was going through college, your generation really holds to this idea that there is a morality out there. Now, we could talk about the points of it or agree or disagree on the ideas of that morality, but your generation absolutely believes that there is a morality. Whether you're talking about global warming and how we're treating the environment, or whether you're talking about overpopularization, or how do you consolidate the Christian sexual ethic with LGBTQ conversations. Like, whatever the conversation is, the idea is, like, there is a truth, there is a morality, there is a right, and there is a wrong. But then we go, well, based on what? Based on what? What is the truth based on? And your generation is struggling because it feels this deep sense of there's a right, there's a wrong, there has to be in the world. But what is it based on? Because if it's based on God, then he has the right to dictate what that is. And so there is this tension where we're like, oh, there is no God, so it's all subjective. But you're saying that this is wrong. Yeah, absolutely wrong. Subjectively? No, well, and we live, there's this guy, Francis Schaeffer, who was this real deep thinker back, you know, kind of post-World War II time, and he was kind of wrestling through a lot of, like, what he saw in the culture there in Europe where he was at. And he said it's so much secularism and Christianity so much are like basically people living in the same house, but the upstairs is for some reason unlivable. And so they can't live in it, so they keep running downstairs where you know there's food in the fridge and there's like clean water and there's like good sanitation. And the upstairs is just unlivable, so they can't live there, but they keep trying to. It's kind of like when I was first here, when first time I lived in Fort Collins, I lived in this place called Lighthouse. It was on Sorority Row. It was being rented by Timberline Church, and they had kind of this Christian co-op with guys and girls living in it that year. And I was just getting ready to pioneer Chi Alpha here at CSU, and I'm like, hey, I just want to get to know students. I wasn't married yet, and I was like, just trying to get to know CSU students. So I lived there. And one night, comically, I think it was the coldest night December had ever had in like over 100 years in Fort Collins. It was, of course, that night. It was in December. It was during finals. And our house mom basically had put this chicken broth on the stove and had left it on. And it was basically acting like a timer all night. It was just boiling down, boiling down, boiling down. And then about 3 in the morning, it got down to the bottom. And it started this kind of oven fire. Now, I was living upstairs, and I opened the door, and what? Smoke just billowing all around. Why? Because smoke is rising. And so what do we have to do? I was running downstairs, trying to, like, you know, it's cold. I'm going to grab my coat. Crap, it's fire. I don't know where it is. I'm running downstairs because it was downstairs where there was life. There was air. There was breath. But upstairs was unlivable because there was this, we were afraid of this fire that was going to consume the house. And it all worked out okay. But that was kind of, although we had to sit there for, and then the fire department was busy on another call, so we had to stand out there forever. One of the fraternity houses next door took pity on us and let us go in for a while. It was great. But that's what we're talking about. It's like, hey, you can't have it both ways. If there's a God, then he has to be able to define what truth and morality and reality is. If there is not a God, then it doesn't matter. It's all subjective anyways. But you can't have it both ways. And Jesus here says, no, there is a way, and it's me, because I am the light. I am the light. I am the way. I am where you find truth. I am where you find reality. I am the one that defines these things for you. But if you would come to me, if you would follow me, I would give you new life. Do we see God in the dark? No. We might see him through a filter, for sure. I love these photos that we're getting right now through with James Webb, you know, the telescope, right? You guys see that? And, you know, more than just like fancy photos on my Instagram post, you know, like there's, you know, the scientists are excited about like research that they're doing. But what is going on with James Webb? They found a way to filter the light in the universe in such a way that they could actually see what's going on behind all of it, right? Because without it, all we see is the sun, and it blots everything out. And even if you look at the sun too long, even with the filter of the you know, atmosphere, it's you know, burn your retina up. If you got too close to any of those stars, it would destroy them. So they had to get, you know, this, what is it, like a sheet of gold that was like thinner than like 1/10 of your hair, and it was like, you know, it's folded out way away from the sun, and so you could, like, you know, it's just pitch dark. Why? Because they needed to get through a filter. Not to hide reality, but to see the reality that they couldn't, that would destroy us otherwise. And so here's Jesus. And John, at the beginning of his gospel, talks about Jesus, and he says he came and tabernacled with us, which was this depiction of Israel going through the desert. And it was this place where the cloud was. It was a place where that God was shrouding himself. And it's really, there's kind of these funny moments throughout the gospels where it's kind of like Jesus almost lets it slip accidentally. If you read, what was it, in John 18, the soldiers come to take him away before his crucifixion. And they're out there, and they ask him, are you Jesus? And he says, I am. It's another of the I ams. We're not going to talk about that one this semester. But he basically says, I am, and they all fall down. He's like, oh, sorry. You know, cover that up a little bit. Sorry, too much power for you right now, right? Like, it's like, what? But it was like the filter just kind of like, he kind of let out his divinity just a little bit there. So that filter, Jesus is saying, I am this place where you can come to know God, where you can come to experience God. Moses said, I want to see your face. God's like, can't. It would just destroy you. But I'm gonna make a way where you can actually know me. That I can bring this down to a place where, yeah, without God's help, we would be in the dark and we'd be stumbling around. But he's like, I know a way. I can find a way to do this where you can get to know me and it won't destroy you. Second thing, a little quicker here, but can't we have light and life without Jesus? I know how offensive some of this sounds to those who are not used to thinking about or following Jesus. You're just narrow-minded, just one of those hateful Christians. You're saying I'm inferior because of what I think, believe is different than yours. And oftentimes people say, I have light in my life. And depending on how we define that, I would say, yeah, absolutely. If you're talking like a morality, then yeah, I'm like, sure. I know a lot of non-Christians that are way better people than a lot of Christians I know. Like, to be moral, sure. And so are you expressing light? Well, yeah. Yeah, sure, you totally are. But if Jesus is right, then the point isn't to say, am I a moral being? It's not to say, I'm a good person. That's not the goal. That's not the ultimate end. It is a means, but it is not the goal. If Jesus is right, I am the light. Those who are going to have life follow me. If that is true, the point is not your goodness. And so the question is, your morality, you might be more moral than I am. Great. Why? Right? The whole conversation, you guys are super moral in this generation. I think so. Like, there's a lot of things I disagree with your morality, but if I want to say, like, you hold to a perception of morality, absolutely. There's this belief that in right and wrong. But why? And is morality even the end? It's kind of like this. This is going to make you guys kind of laugh, maybe. Some of you. Can you be romantic and not in a relationship? All the single ladies. Joel over there. Oh, all right. So he loves walking with, you know, cool evening and Horsetooth Reservoir in the beach. I don't know. Okay, so I'm not very romantic. Lindsay's like, you could be more romantic. I'm like, I know, I need to work on it. I'm in a relationship. I don't think I'm that good at romantic. Other people are good at being romantic, but they're not in a relationship. Here's the point. If the goal of romance, if you're just like, hey, I'm a romantic person, that's how you see yourself, that's how you define yourself, then the significant other, is your romance for the significant other, or is the significant other just there to give you an outlet for your romantic tendencies? What's the point? What's the goal? And so Jesus says this thing. He says, love God is the greatest commandment, and love your neighbor is like it. He said, actually, all the law and the prophets, all the rules, all the do's, all the don'ts, all the morality is based on that. It hangs on that. It's for that. That's the purpose. That's the whole point. That this morality is for a relationship with Jesus. This is just how you love Jesus. Right? If you're going to get to know somebody, you do things that they love and you don't do things that they hate. This is just helping you to know how to love the God that you're trying to follow. But if you're trying to be moral without following God, it's like, what's the point? Honestly, I'm going to get myself in trouble saying this way, but if you don't believe in God, then who cares? Live hedonistically. Live selfishly. Even Paul says, you know, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, we should be most pitied. Because we're following after a delusion and there's no point to it. But if God is real, then this is the way to life. This is the way to life. So, are we loving God? Are we following him? Is he the point? Or is he simply a means to your own satisfaction, edification, and ultimate ambitions? Is he the God of life? Because we have to say, rules without relationship lead to rebellion. If you have morality, but you don't have a relationship with God, and I'm talking to you Christians in the room, if you have morality, like I can, you know, I read my Bible every day, and I pray, and I, you know, I do my things, and I'm on Sunday morning, I'm there, and whatever, Wednesday night with Outpost, and, you know, I have a small group. If I can do all the right things, but I'm not striving to draw close to my God, then Just why? Give it up. But the point is this following, to draw close to a God who has been pursuing after us. And so here is this Jesus, and he's standing there in front of these religious leaders, these Pharisees. And he basically says, hey guys, I am the light. I am the way to life. And they say, you can't be a witness. And at the very end, they make this really funny statement. They said, you know, John says, basically, they didn't kill him because his time hadn't come. Which has this premise to it that, like, they wanted to kill him. And they're making all these accusations to him, like, hey, you don't have two witnesses. Which is really this Levitical law, if you actually read in Numbers and Deuteronomy, that if you thought somebody justified the death penalty, you needed to at least have a couple of witnesses to make anything valid. I mean, keep in mind, God's, you know, he's filtering some morality down into their context, you know, this tribal, you know, mobile society, and he's trying to help lead them into, like, how to, like, love your neighbor, right? So he's just like, hey, basic justice, basic 101, you in and of yourself are going to manipulate, distort, contort, and deceive even yourself in what you believe, think, you know, understand. You're not a good basis for justice. And so at least have another witness or two if you're going to do something so severe. And so this is what they're referencing. Is like, hey, who are your witnesses? Because they're standing in judgment of Jesus. They're standing in judgment of him. And they're saying, you are not worthy. It's interesting is other times Jesus would people would have doubt and he would really help them out. He just tells these guys, you don't know God, you don't know me, you don't know anything. But to doubting Thomas, he said, hey, here I am. You know, touch my side, touch my hand, see where I like died. And the difference seems to be pretty clear in the expression throughout the narratives of Jesus is that the heart posture matters deeply in how Jesus responded to people. If they were standing in judgment of Jesus, if they were standing as judges, because that's what they're saying, I'm standing as a judge over you and I find you wanting. A lot of people in the world find Jesus wanting. If they stand in judgment saying, yeah, we find you wanting, then to our worldview, our ideas, our ideology, our ambitions, if you are getting in the way of my life, my worldview, the way that I think things should be, then you're going to judge Jesus. And he's like, okay, you can judge me. But he also says to others, hey, if you're just trying to see if I am the rightful judge, I'll help you. I'll help you out. I'll walk with you. I'll lead you. I'll show you who I am. I'll show you my character. I'll show you my nature. I'll show you who I am. And to Thomas, he said, hey, it's okay. I'm with you. So do we come to Jesus with a critical spirit? You'll find justification for what you want. Are you standing in judgment seat, or are you trying to assess if Jesus rightfully deserves to sit at the judgment seat of your heart? Do you desire to follow him? In verse 12, he says, whoever follows me will have the light of life. It's the only faith that was ever created. If you look at all the major religions, that God himself says, I have come. I am the source. I showed up. Not a representative for someone else, but I myself have come that you might know. Yes, filtered so that you won't die. But I have come that you might know me. You might draw near to me. Worship team can come back up. I think Justin's going to come up here for a couple minutes. But Matthew 27, verse 45 says, from noon until 3 in the afternoon, darkness came over all the land. About 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice. And commentators comment that this had to have been said. A literary critique has a hard time getting away from this because it seems so innately obvious that somebody who was writing this, John, but somebody who was writing this couldn't write the story without hearing these words when he said, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? See, Jesus came down and he was light. And he was the one who experienced Ichabod. on our behalf. We're the ones who should have been cast out from the presence of God. We're the ones who deserve to have darkness in our lives, the realities that we experience. Because if you doubt that, just let me ask you, where is the darkness in your life? Every one of you could tell me. And you could tell me darkness that has been done to you and darkness that you have done to others. Both. You could do both. I just know in the moment, not saying anything, because I could know in my own heart I could say that. But Jesus, he was light. He was the author of life. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he came that we might know him, but he was on the cross, and that presence, that glory, that Shekinah was ripped from him. And that cross, we see it, and in some ways, it is just a filtered, minimized hint that just is enough for us to kind of grasp what actually was going on the cross, which was horrific in all of his expressions, but was only one aspect of what was happening, because Jesus was not, "I hurt," it was, "My Father, why have you forsaken me?" That was the destruction, that was the death, that was the separation from his Father. He experienced darkness so that his light might enter our lives and bring us out of darkness into marvelous light. And so whether you're a non-Christian, I'll just ask you, do you want to live finding the reason why your heart cries for justice and morality and truth? Do you want to know the author of life itself? We'd love to introduce you to him. And for you Christians, are you living in that light? Or are you living in places where the darkness is starting to invade and starting to fill your heart and your mind? Are you letting that darkness in and pushing the light of Christ out? Jesus said, "You are the light of the world." He said, "Hey, you know, as my followers, as my followers, you are the light and the salt. You are the light in the world." And yet, is your light shining? Is it shining with your Instagram posts? Is it shining with your Netflix binging? Is it shining with what you did Saturday night and what you did, you know, Tuesday morning? Is your decisions about your major shining the light of Christ in your life? Is your relationship modeling an expression of the light in your life, or is it a distraction in darkness drawing near into your heart? What is expressing itself in your life? And so we're just going to take a few minutes. We're going to get together, have you guys get together and just break up into, you know, get a small group leader, or if you don't know who a small group leader is, just go with whoever brought you. And if you're in a small group, get with that small group leader, and if you're not, just grab somebody. Small group leaders, feel free to just get together with other people tonight. That's great. That's fine if you don't have anybody specifically. But let's get together, and I want one of the leaders, if you would, just ask, hey, is there anywhere where you're experiencing the darkness? Maybe darkness that has been done to you, and you feel hurt. You feel those potentials that were never meant, you know in your heart, were never meant to be part of your reality have invaded into your heart. And you're like, you're still working through that thing that happened to you. And you just want some prayer. We'd love to pray with you. And maybe you're that person that said, hey, I have been living in the darkness and I need to turn into his light. Maybe for the first time, maybe in different ways. But if we would just be honest enough with each other for a moment to just ask that, if a leader wouldn't mind just asking. If you don't want to share, if there's nothing to share, that's okay. That's great. I'm not trying to force something. But if there is, we just want to give space, because we love to lean on each other. We love to support one another and walk together in following Jesus, who has given us light in our hearts and life to our bodies in a way that we never understood before him, but we will forever be growing after we begin to follow. Because he cried, God, he paid the price, and he separated himself, and he let the darkness in so that his light could shine in our hearts. Let's pray and turn to him for a few minutes tonight. Lord, we worship you in our hearts, in our minds, in our souls, in our spirits, in those places that hurt sometimes, those places that are our source of value and meaning and purpose, Lord, we say you are the light that defines all those things for us, God. We surrender our lives. We're grateful that you made a way where there seemed no way. You made your truth become real and evident to us in our world and in our reality. And we thank you, God, that we can draw near to that light and we can see everything else through that light in our lives, our relationships, our friendships, our careers, and our ambitions, God. All of them get refined and directed in the light of your goodness and grace. We meditate on it and we recognize it and we surrender to it in our hearts tonight. In Jesus' name, we love you. Amen.